Thanks, Jen, for the opportunity to talk to this group. I've been talking with and listening to artists for many, many years. And I thought I would start, I'm supposed to do what Rob would have done. Okay, so I'm a faculty member here at Perimeter Institute. I work in quantum gravity and cosmology and foundations of quantum mechanics and particle physics and a few other things. But that's not what I want to talk to you about. I want to start by telling one of the stories that got me into engagement with arts, because it's a story about a social context that raises some issues about the relationship between the arts, especially music, visual arts, performance arts, et cetera, more than literary arts, and the sciences. And so I'll start with this story, and then I want to talk about the particular issue that I'm writing about and thinking about now as much philosophically as a scientist, although there are aspects of both, which is the issue of whether time is real or emergent. But let me start with the story and the context. One place to start a discussion of the relationship between arts and sciences is with C.P. Snow, who very famously in the 1920s, I believe, wrote an essay in which he decried the existence of two cultures, a culture of sciences and a culture of the arts, and complained that educated, credentialed people in one of them are ignorant about the basic foundations of the others. And he complained about this. Now, before we go further, I think it's important to make a correction that when C.P. Snow, in the context of the British Academy, is talking about the arts, he really means the humanities. And he really means history, literature, philosophy, and so forth. It's not clear that he was talking about visual arts, but nonetheless, the challenge stands. Now, in the 1980s, John Brockman, who I don't know if, is he somebody who's known in this group? John Brockman is a kind of impresario of things intellectual and cultural. He's also a literary agent, so he has an interest in what he advocates. As a literary agent, he is the premier agent for scientists who write books. So I have to, well, it's part of the story. He invented what he called the idea of the third culture. And the idea of the third culture is the idea that the traditional public intellectuals who traditionally come from literary backgrounds, people like C.P. Snow himself, Lionel Trilling, that genre, Bertrand Russell, of public intellectuals, have advocated the scene. And they've advocated the scene because they've gotten involved in erudite and specialized discussions about deconstructionism and postmodernism and things that are hard to get a broad audience for. And so the scene of public intellectuals and the influence of public intellectuals being absent, he introduced the idea that there's a new kind of public intellectual who is either a scientist, an artist, by which he really does mean a visual artist or a musician or a performance artist, or what he called the digerati, which are the people who are remaking digital culture. And he spoke about, and also, as I'll describe in a sense, created a community of people in these three areas who talk to each other and who have a common interest in the future, which is, after all, what intellectuals and artists talk about most often when we really talk, which is, what is the future bringing in? How can we shape the future? And I, sometime later, in the mid-90s, I became his client. And one of the things that happened as a result of that is that I was invited to a salon, which was a sort of actualization of the idea of the third culture, in New York, hosted at the apartment of a collector, and I'm afraid I don't remember the name of the collector, where I gave a talk about the idea that laws may evolve in time, which is the idea that I was writing about then. And there was a lively discussion, and there was a guy in the corner who asked the most interesting and penetrating questions. And later on, I have a cousin who's a rock and roll musician, and I was going downtown to have a drink with him afterwards. And we ended up fighting for a cab with somebody who turned out to be the same guy in the corner. So we got in the same cab, and I brought him along. And my cousin actually, as is the case often with him, as a rock and roll musician, never showed up. So so I spent the evening with this artist who turned out to be St. Clair Simin. I don't know if he's a name who's known but he's certainly known in New York and Paris. And we had the most wonderful conversation. It evolved slowly, very slowly, into a friendship. In fact, I had no idea that he was an interesting artist until I came down with the flu, and he, for no reason at all, because we hardly knew each other, brought some things to the apartment so that I would have chicken soup and so forth. And then when I was a little better, he picked me up and took me to his studio in Red Hook, which was about the size of the Black Hole Bistro doubled. And walking around, I realized that this was an artist of some interest and some power. And through St. Clair, I became friends with a remarkable group of artists in New York, Beth Turk, Donna Moylan, Ray Smith, Ron Gorchov, Vic Moonis, and who were sort of collected around St. Clair. And what was interesting about them is that they were optimistic and positive about the future. They had a response to postmodernism. And I can quote St. Clair on it. This comes just from a conversation, and I used this conversation in the book that I was writing then. I used this quote. Because as an academic and a theorist, I was very interested in what all this theory was about. I'm a theorist, I'm supposed to understand theories. I would go to seminars in the philosophy and literature department trying to understand. I didn't understand a word. Now eventually I got to hear Derrida himself, and he was crystal clear, even though on the page I couldn't understand a word of him. So I was asking St. Clair and Donna often, you know, what is this postmodern deconstruction stuff? So St. Clair once at a party said, if the purpose of modernism in art was to burn down the old house of classicism, then all that postmodernism is doing is playing with the little charred pieces that are left over, which is a pretty puerile thing to be doing considering that winter is coming. So that was the attitude of that school. They embraced the idea, they embraced the critique of postmodernism, but then went on and embraced the notion that there's value to making art, there's value to craft, there's value to beauty, there's value to communication, and especially there is value to conversation about the future and making the future of society. So that's what I learned. And taking it to my work as a scientist, I learned, because I was also somebody who was always interested in philosophy. And of course, there is the critique of, kind of in response to Popper, of Feyerabend, particularly the structure of scientific revolutions, whose name, whose author, I just cannot remember. Kuhn, Thomas Kuhn, Tom Kuhn, Lakatosh, and so on, that science doesn't progress the way that traditionally we have the idea that there's a scientific method. I mean, Feyerabend's critique that there is no scientific method, that scientists are opportunists who do whatever they need to get ahead and to make discoveries, I think holds. And without an embracement, I don't know if that's a word, but without embracing a set of values, you're left with a vacuum, you're left with a void. And what I learned from these artists is that to have a foundation for your work, for your creative work, you have to embrace a set of values, that you have to believe in the description of nature and its possibility as a scientist. You have to believe in the possibility of the progression of knowledge, even if there is no scientific method. And I'm quite convinced that there is no scientific method and that Feyerabend is right and that scientists are opportunists. Nonetheless, there are standards of honesty and explanation that we impose on each other as scientists, as part of a scientific community. And that was an invaluable lesson and has kept me going for ever since. There are two other things I should say I think I learned from my encounters with these artisan friendships. One of them is how to work on more than one thing at a time. Particularly from St. Clair, from Ray Smith, when we'd go to their studios and there would be a dozen, 15 works in progress at the same time, and they would walk around and work on one and then work on another in different materials and different genres. I'm one of these people who is disordered and plagued by having too many ideas, so it's a problem managing them, and I learned something about project management, if you will. Because one thing, well, I could go on about that, but let that be enough. The other thing I learned was generosity. And I learned it from Elizabeth Turp, from Donna Moylan, from Brian Eno, who I came to know in London. An enormous generosity to ideas, to people who are trying to do something. And that has also carried me through a great deal. And of course, coming here to Perimeter and being the receipt of enormous generosity, which is continuing in support of all of our work here, one tries to be a little bit generous back to people, other people in the area and people in the field. Okay, so with all that as a kind of introduction, maybe I can, I thought about what to do because, you know, in 10 or 15 minutes, how to expose you to a piece of science. So I thought I'd just jump in the deep end and talk about the issue of time, which is an issue that I'm writing about now and that also motivates a lot of my scientific work in different ways. Here's the issue in a nutshell. And by the way, I know there are physicists here. I recognize you guys. And I know you may disagree with what I'm about to say, but I'm not talking to you all. Okay? And so I want lots of comments from everybody else, but you have me, you know, 7 days a week. You can get to me later with disagreement. Okay. So there is a particular issue about time in physics, which is that there's a particular trick which is played by the way that laws of physics are structured, in which time is reduced or eliminated. And this is something that Einstein contributed greatly to with the general theory of relativity, but it's also something that he was very concerned with. We have, not very much in his own writings, but we have, there's a wonderful passage in an autobiography of Carnap, who was a philosopher, an important philosopher from Vienna, who relates the disquieting conversations he had with Einstein, in which Einstein worried incessantly that the now was gone from physics, that there was no way to represent the now or the present moment. And Carnap uses the opportunity to be very sneering and condescending about how the scientist doesn't understand the difference between appearance and reality. And obviously, reality is what science describes, which is obviously timeless and there's no issue. And we don't really have Einstein's response. What was Einstein worried about? Well, here's how we describe, there's a general framework by which we describe systems, and this can be in quantum mechanics, in Newtonian physics, in field theory, in the standard model in general relativity, also in computer science, which is we make a model in which we write down all the possible states that a system might be in, and we make a space of states For example, we might consider this room as a system, and you know, at some level of description which we choose, whether it's where the people are sitting or where the molecules and the atoms are, there's a point in here. Each point in here represents a possible state or configuration of the contents of this room. And there's some particular point which is the content now. Okay. And so this we can call the configuration space. And the interesting thing about it is that it's assumed that we can just do that for all time. That is, there's no time present in that description. Those are all the possible states that the room might be in, or configurations the room might be in. And then to talk about change, which is after all what physics is about, a large part of physics is about, is not only what configurations are possible, but how things change in time. We first of all define time. So time is a clock sitting outside the system. It's not part of the system. Time is noted by a clock outside the system. And as a system changes in time, we get a series of configurations. And that's the history of the system, if we imagine that time is continuous. That's the history of the system. That might be the history of this room from, you know, 8 o'clock in this morning until now, when the speaker runs off the page and nobody knows what's going to happen next. And the search for physics is for laws. And the laws are assumed to, given some configuration or state, if you know the state at some time, you can predict what the future states are. That is, the laws give curves which are possible histories or possible evolutions of the system on the configuration space. So those are the laws. And both the laws and the configurations are specified timelessly, by which it means there's no idea that these change. They're just specified once and for all. Once you know the configuration space and you know the laws, you do physics. How do you do physics? You prepare the system in some initial system that's called fixing the initial configuration, and then you apply the law. You let the clock evolve, and then you say, at 3 p.m., this is what we predict the configuration of the system will be. Okay. And that's the way physics is organized. Almost every important physical theory is organized that way. Now, if that's the way nature is, then time has a very limited appearance in the situation. Here's one reason why. You name me any property of the world at 3 o'clock, any property you might want to ask, does the system have this property at 3 o'clock? And I can run the math backwards and turn that into a question about the initial conditions. Because these equations are deterministic, and even in quantum physics, they're deterministic. So there is no question that we could ask about 3 p.m. that couldn't be rephrased as a question about, let's say, 11 a.m. when we set up the initial conditions. Okay. And therefore, there's no novelty, there's no surprise, there's nothing that can be unanticipated, there's nothing that we can learn from nature. Once we learn this framework, we know everything, allegedly. Okay. So this is part of the problematic. One way to say it is that what Einstein and many others have embraced is the claim that what's real is not the present moment. I mean, we experience everything in a moment, which is one of a succession of moments. But the claim is that that somehow is, quote, an illusion, a epiphenomena having to do with the second law of thermodynamics and the fact that we burn a lot of heat or something. And the reality, the real world, is the whole history at once, what's called the block universe picture. Another motivation, which I'll just mention, but it's a strong motivation for the block universe picture, is that with special relativity, and even more with general relativity, there's a relativity of simultaneity, which you may have probably have heard about. That is, if I ask, what is simultaneous with me snapping my fingers now and a particular planet around a particular star in Andromeda, it depends on what observer is asking the question and how they're moving. There's no well-defined absolute sense to what is happening right now, distant places. And so physics is robbed of the possibility of taking the state of the world as some sort of succession of nows, the way, say, that Henri Bergson might have advocated, seriously, because there are different nows depending on the motion of the observer. And this is a serious issue. And I think that those who want physics, those who want, with Einstein's disquiet, to want to respond to Einstein's disquiet and believe that there is some reality in the present moment, a reality in the now, have to contradict that conclusion of special and general relativity. That is, we have to believe that there really is a simultaneous moment which has meaning in physics, which means that we have to search for its appearance experimentally, in reformulation of theories, in the marriage of general relativity and cosmology with quantum theory. And that's where it becomes a scientific issue. Do we think that the destruction of the notion of the reality of the now in general relativity in classical physics is for good, or do we think that a deeper physics, which of course in this building our job is to discover the deeper physics, to complete the, if I can put it this way, to complete the job that Einstein started by almost simultaneously initiating the revolutions of quantum theory and relativity by joining them together, is the, what is going to be the notion of time in this unification? So it becomes a scientific issue and informs some of the work and some of the debates going on in this building. So I think I've maybe said enough to set the issue. I can say lots more if you want in this direction, but maybe I'll pause for comments. And again, not the scientists, because you can tell me later.
I'm curious about your two terms that you're contrasting, real and emergent time. Is an emergent time not a real time? I'm wondering what you mean by those two labels.
Well, sure. So a theory in physics has a fundamental language, which it has, if you like, an ontology. The things that it asserts are part of the fabric of nature, are real. And then there are other things, what I mean, and let's call those fundamental things. Emergent properties are things that are constructions made out of the fundamental things that aren't a useful language in every configuration, in every history. For example, temperature is an emergent quantity. Okay? At an atomic level of description, we believe just that each atom has a, well, what we really believe, some of us, is that each atom has a quantum state. But let me talk in Newtonian language. Each atom has a trajectory of motion. It has a velocity. And that's it. In a coarse-grained description in which we only talk about average quantities over large distances, we can make a hypothesis that there's an average energy of motion, and that's what's called temperature. But that's only a useful language in a small subset of configurations, those which are in equilibrium. So what it means to advocate that time is emergent is to advocate that you can give a complete description of nature in which there's no reference to time. And I can give you an example in a moment, And time would be something that would occur in some cases or in some situations. Okay? So let me give an example. Julian Barber who is a very interesting figure who's had a lot of influence on myself, probably you would say the same thing on many of the people in this building, wrote a book called The End of Time. In my own case, a lot of my thinking about time has come out over the many years. I met Julian, he thinks we met in 1980, but I think we met in 1979. he's probably right, because he's one of these people who can remember the date that any event happened on, just like that, you know. When did we go to such and such a party? March 13th, 1988. But in spite of that capacity, he doesn't believe that time is real. What he believes is that he believes that memory is real, and it's a very interesting thing why he believes that memory is real. He believes instead of this space of configurations in the history, there's just a whole bunch of configurations, what he calls the heap. Nature consists of a big, huge collection of how the universe might be at a moment. Each one is a configuration of how the universe might be at the moment. Okay? And that's all. That's it. There's no ordering to them. They don't live in a space. There's no histories. There's just, okay? And right now, you are experiencing one of those. You are in one of those. Now you're in another one of those. Now you're in another one of those. Okay, and your experience is just some of them have, you know, experiencing agents caught inside them at the moment. Finally, I snapped my fingers. I've been trying to do that since I was 12. and Julian believes that that's all that's reality, but some of them are more common than others. They can be copies of them. So there's some of them that appear just once, and there are others that there are many copies of. So you want to know what might the configuration, you just tell a story about which are more likely than others. They all exist. They all, quote, are happening, although there's no progression of time. Okay? And down here, there's a particularly popular bunch. And the particularly popular bunch are those that have structures in them that he calls time capsules that make it plausible that there were other moments that had some relation to ours. So, for example, we live in a moment in a room where there are a lot of chairs. So it's plausible to say that there were probably other moments where people made those chairs. So there's a lot of structure in these moments which talk about other moments, and therefore it's possible to arrange approximate sequences by asking questions about chairs and tables and human memory and things like that. But if you look too closely, there is no real logical coherent causal sequence. So time is an illusion created by not looking too closely. And by the fact that we happen to be in these popular moments. So that's an example. That's an interpretation of a formulation of quantum gravity that many of us have worked on, and it's an interpretation of the mathematics, but I don't need to teach you the mathematics to explain that. Okay. So when I talk to Julian, I say, look, I believe in your moments. I just think that there's a causal progression of them. And I think, and I like to hope that if we knew the real laws of physics, when we know the real laws of physics, go down under quantum mechanics and the statistical nature of quantum mechanics, we will have a theory that has causal progressions. But I also believe something else, which is I believe that it will not be capturable in this schema. And will not be capturable in this schema for several reasons. One of them is that the schema falls apart and becomes a reducto when you try to apply it to cosmology, to the universe as a whole. Why is that? Because it's useful that there are many possible configurations and that you can start the system off in many possible configurations when you have a small subsystem of the universe. Because you can create the conditions to run an experiment over and over and over again, and you can both validate the experiment, which is important. And I was so tempted to talk to you about an experiment that desperately needs validation where some neutrinos are going faster than light, but that'll have to be another time. Also, you can separate out what's the role of the initial conditions from the role of the law by studying the same system over and over again with different initial conditions. When it comes to the universe as a whole, we don't control the initial conditions. We don't observe all the initial conditions because we only observe a piece of the universe. Okay? And there's only one trajectory. There's only one history. All the others are extravagant. Why do we need a theory that talks of an infinite number of universes that never happen? So I hope, the theory I hope for, will have one trajectory, but it won't have one law. Because, and this I'll just say and throw out there, I don't think that there is a mathematical law that corresponds perfectly to nature. And therefore, I don't see any reason for there to be one timeless law as opposed to laws that hold approximately for certain times or for certain regimes. And in fact, I see a lot of advantages to not having one timeless law, which is that if there is one timeless law, it's inexplicable. And this is something that Charles Sanders Peirce, the inventor of American pragmatism, understood very clearly. There's nothing, I'm quoting him, so in need of explanation as a law. And if you just say that's the law of nature, you're being a mystic. And the one thing that at least I don't want to be as a scientist is a mystic. I want to understand, I want to comprehend. And also to quote Peirce, laws must evolve if they are to be explained. If something, laws have quite a lot of structure and information, and if that structure and information is to be explained, it must be the result of some process that led to it. There doesn't seem to be any a priori justification for the laws of physics. We've been down that road, we've been there, we've done that, it doesn't work. There are lots of possible laws of nature. And if there's to be an explanation for the one that holds in this era, it must be historical. And again, Peirce understood that. Roberto Unger understood that, an important contributor to American pragmatism. He would not like to be described that way, but that's what he is contemporarily. And through a long process, I've come to believe that. Okay, let me stop there. There was a hand.
Are you not, I don't think it's...
It's on.
Are you not pointing to the possibility that perhaps space itself is emergent?
I didn't mention a word about that, but yes, I think that space is emergent. I don't have any problem with space being emergent. There are several reasons to think that space is emergent. If there is a theory behind quantum mechanics that describes individual phenomenon, it must have a great deal of non-locality in it. That's Bell's theorem and entanglement and so forth. And so therefore, it behooves us to, if we want to go down that road, and look for what people used to call a hidden variable theory. It has to be one in which somehow properties are shared by systems once they interact and become entangled, no matter how far apart they separate. And it's easier to believe in that if space is emergent. That's one reason. Then there are some reasons that come out of my own field of quantum gravity. There's something that we call the inverse problem, which is that there are a number of different theories and approaches which hold that space or space-time is discrete, is made out of discrete elements. And loop quantum gravity is one of them. Causal sets, causal dynamical triangulations, there's a number of them. And they all have the following property, which is that it's very easy to imagine that the world with the classical geometry of space that we understand is composed of discrete elements. But if you invent a game of putting together a world from those discrete elements, you almost never get back something that looks like a nice, smooth Euclidean space. And you can do that yourselves. Let me just, I take a piece of paper and I imagine that it's made of triangles. I do what's called the triangulation of it. I imagine that it's really made up of a lot of triangles all fitted together. And you could do that. You could take a piece of paper and cut it up into, this kind of things you guys do, right? Some of you anyway. Some of you do it on computers. But anyway, my five-year-old does it. You take a piece of paper and cut it up into a lot of triangles. Okay, so all those triangles came from a piece of paper. Okay, but now think about all the ways to glue those triangles back together again, where the only rule is that every one is glued to some other ones on an edge. Okay, and you're going to get a mess if you start gluing triangles together haphazardly. If you're not very, very, very careful, you're not going to reassemble something that looks like a flat piece of paper. You're going to get a total mess. Okay? So that's what we call the inverse problem, and it appears in loop quantum gravity. It appears in all of these fields. Yeah. So let me just finish. You may think, okay, if I was a scientist listening to this, I would think, you just explained why space can't be emergent, because if it's not put in there, it's hard to get it back. And that's kind of true. But the point is that it's a challenging scientific question to understand why space might be emergent out of some atomic description, the way that, say, solids, this piece of plastic has properties which are emergent from the atoms in it. Okay.
Question, comment, I guess, about the idea of time being emergent and it being able to be sort of built up and brought back down, or like for your line that joins the 3 p.m. and the 11 a.m., there's an implied error at either end, right? Because mm-hmm. you said from 11 a.m. we can figure out for 3 p.m. and from 3 p.m. we can figure out 11 a.m. So the time can go backwards and forwards, and then okay, so the idea of the, like, when you still had the rectangle and all the possibilities are there, or even just all the possibilities on a line, and how we experience time or how we notate time and whether it's linear or not. So the idea was you can have a shaman that goes into shamanic space to answer the question, who stole the chicken, right? Mm-hmm. Or will it rain this week or not? And so he goes into his crazy space, and while he's in that crazy space, it's no longer, quote-unquote, difficult for him to see who stole the chicken, because he simply looks. And he says, oh, so-and-so stole the chicken, or he looks and says, yes, on Wednesday it will rain. Right? So then what kind of space is the shamanic space, except maybe the space of the rectangle, where sort of everything is happening, everything is possible, but there is a formality of being that some things did happen and some things will happen.
Okay, let me address your question on two things, because you asked about the directionality and the arrow of time, and then you asked about shamanistic traditions, okay? So let me address those in reverse order, okay? I'm going to duck totally the second question. That is, I am a member of a tradition that believes that knowledge is sought in a certain way. it's sought through community. I'll tell you my belief, that we seek knowledge through communities, through the action of individuals working in communities, where we deeply believe in the fallibility of human judgment and perception, and deeply believe in our abilities to fool ourselves and fool each other, which is why there are sanctions about lying, because it's so easy. And this tradition develops very critically a set of techniques, a set of methods, whose primary purpose, whether they're experimental or mathematical, is to discover mistakes. Okay? To be a member of this tradition, in my view, you have to do two things. You have to adhere to a kind of ethics, which are things like tell the truth, be self-critical, and you have to master a set of methods and techniques which enable you to put forward claims that can survive critical scrutiny by other critical people trained with the same methods and the same techniques. Okay? Now, to be a successful member of this tradition, you have to be both very respectful and very rebellious. You have to be very respectful of the confines and the boundaries and the methodology and the history. And you also have to believe that unaccountably you could do better than your teachers, because otherwise why bother? Okay? So that's the intellectual world I work in. Okay. Somebody comes to me from a different tradition and they say, in my tradition we know of people who can travel. Okay. I have nothing to say. I have a temptation to say, to be uppity and to say, you know, my tradition has high standards because we believe that probably any claim that anybody would make, including our claims to each other, are false and are fooling ourselves. Have you gone through a rigorous process? But we have, but I don't need to, it doesn't get me anything to do that, because I don't, you know, I'm happy there are other traditions. I'm a pluralist. It doesn't bother me. But I can't say anything. I can have an interesting dinner or drink with a shaman, and I have. Okay, and I should say that my parents were interested in mysticism of different kinds, so I've had a lot of exposure to non-Western traditions of different kinds, and it's an interesting conversation, but I have nothing to say. Okay, now about the directionality of time, I have a lot to say. So let me use your question to talk about that. There is an issue in standard physics up till now, and the issue is that the laws of nature, with one little exception that doesn't really matter for what I'm about to say, are reversible. You have a possible trajectory. Let me put back the space, okay? And you could run it backwards, and it's still a possible trajectory. So you could take everything that's happened in this room today and run it backwards, and it's a possible solution to the laws of physics. Okay. Now, this is a problem because this radically disagrees with observation and experiment. This implies, for example, there are solutions of the equations that light satisfies, okay, that would have, every time I move, the light goes out and it goes into the past rather than going out into the future. So every time I snap my fingers, there's a solution where the sound waves go out into the past and out into the future, which means you're not perceiving what happened a little while ago up here in the front of the room. You're perceiving what's going to happen in a little while. Okay? It's perfectly consistent with the laws of physics that we understand them. We only use half the solutions of the laws of physics, those in which time is strongly ordered. Now, there's two ways to approach, and there's a long speech. I mean, there's a lot to say about this. But roughly speaking, there's two possibilities. One of them is that time is real, and it really does have an order, and the future is different from the past. And the other one is you've got to do a whole lot of work to explain the really bizarre fact that our universe has a strong directionality in time, while the laws don't. And what you end up got to do is you got to point to some initial conditions, actually way back in the early history of the universe, that were so improbable and unlikely that they imparted a directionality of time, not just then, but for hundreds of billions of years since then. You have to pick initial conditions. That is, the whole directionality of the observed universe has to be laid to a very, very special, unlikely choice of initial conditions. Okay. It's either that or you just believe that time is real and it has a direction. So you can choose your methodology. The question is open. Okay, question?
I'm really enjoying what you have to say. I just want to say that. I love the different aspects of art and science that you've brought together in this talk. And I'd just also like to thank the organizers for this event. I think it's amazing. I'm an artist. I'm a performance artist and a media artist. And I'm an Aboriginal person. And the reason I say that is that I want to thank you for bringing up the thing about the guy who can see the chicken stealer. Because this is actually why I've come today, is that compared to a person who, say, has no experience of it, I have a large understanding of the, if you wish, shamanistic traditions of my culture. That said, compared to someone who studies that, as who is a shaman or a medicine person, I know absolutely nothing about it. And I also, compared to an average person, know a lot about science, but compared to someone like yourself, I know nothing about it at all. So I have these two confounding worlds that I believe in equally. Mm-hmm. So I very much believe in the scientific process and those methodologies. But at the same time, I have a deep experiential and spiritual conviction or set of convictions around the guy who can see the chicken stealer. So I've actually come here to in my quest to reconcile these two worlds. So even though I very much appreciate your deft and your deft, polite, and gracious and graceful ducking of the chicken stealing question, I'm interested in hearing what other people have to say about that over the course of the day. So I don't really have a question at all.
Yeah, sure.
I know better now what I was trying to say, I think. So. Basically, okay, so you have this experience as a person, biological person on the planet, and then there's this experience of the world as a scientist, as a physicist. And so when you look at the laws, you say, oh, well, the laws, really, you could go backwards and forwards. They don't care. And in some ways, maybe there isn't even any time. We don't have it. The laws don't care. We can still work the system without time at all. But then as a person, you have this definite experience of time, and even when you're a shaman, you know, you still chew and swallow second, and you still have this very experiential experience of time as linear. So I guess maybe my question is, but if you're saying, well, I'm a scientist, and the laws tell me this, why... Like how do you say, well, how much of my experience as a human being of time, how much am I trying just mm-hmm. to force fit it into the system where there is no indication from within the system that there is time?
Mm-hmm. That's my question too.
Okay.
No. Let me just formulate. Okay, this was Einstein's disquiet. Okay. Everything we experience, know, feel, etc., is in a moment which is in a succession of moments. Okay, that's the way the world is presented to us. Now, either the world is that way fundamentally, in which case physics should mirror it, however imperfectly. One of the things I used to believe but don't believe is that the role of physics is to find some mathematical timeless object which mirrors nature perfectly. Okay, and one of the reasons I don't believe that, let me just go with that for a second, is that there's one property that the real world seems to have that no mathematical object has, which is that it's always some moment. So I have come full score around in the course of my thinking of these things to be very disquieted as apparently Einstein was. Okay. Whether it's possible to implement something within a scientific description of the world, I don't know, because my job is as a scientist to develop within the tradition. I said, and let me, even though you let me duck, let me come back to the shaman thing. Okay, look, I've known a lot of people who were engaged in various kinds of mystical traditions. Okay, a small handful of them deeply impressed me. Okay, there's a friend of my family who's in his middle 90s, who is bright-eyed, upright, you know, wise, healthy, Okay. He is allowed to take me aside and say, look, I've read what you wrote. You're completely ignoring the fact that the world is made of consciousness. Okay? And he is somebody who has the moral authority, the age, the stance, that I just shut up and listen. Okay? But it's got to be somebody like that, in my experience, because I know a lot of people who thought they had something to say and it just dissolved into things that felt very soft and sort of scary and swishy. I don't know how to say it, okay? But I do believe that there are people who have practiced traditions all their lives who know something that I don't know. But I don't know how to incorporate that, and I don't know if it's my job to incorporate that to my work. When people ask me about consciousness, I say, you know, let's first understand everything we can about the physical world. Let's understand time. Let's understand what biology is and how biology works and what life is. And then 200 or 300 years from now, when those agendas are satisfied, the people who are fortunate enough to be doing science then can worry about consciousness. My job is just to get, you know, increase knowledge a little bit, you know, get from the first 3 minutes after the Big Bang to the first 3 minutes before the Big Bang.
Yeah, I think, I mean, there's two pieces. There's the directionality, and then there's this strange intensity of the current moment that we directly experience. And I think Wheeler had this sort of psychophysical evolutionary idea for why the present moment was so intense, which is basically because right now is the only time it's worth making any action to survive. And so the argument is that our brains are somehow designed or wired so that the present moment seems brighter than all the other moments simply because this is the moment to take action, and there's no point in having an intense experience of 10 minutes ago because 10 minutes ago the tiger ate you or whatever. So do you think that there's, when you sort out this question of the present in physics, do you think you're going to end up having to think about those kind of psychophysical, psychological, or even brain issues, or do you think you can solve the problem without doing that?
I hope not, because as I've just said, I genuinely think that. You know, I believe in the progress of science, and one of the things I believe is that there are problems which are solvable at any particular moment, and problems that we don't have the concepts of the language to approach. Okay, I think and by the way, I don't want to give the wrong impression. The ideas that I've talked to you about are not my daily bread and butter here. I mean, I don't every day come in and do work about related to the issue of the reality of time. Okay. I'm not brave enough to do that, and I'm more pragmatic in my own priorities. I try sometimes in writing and in some of the scientific work I do to push those issues. Okay? I think that maybe they're pushable right now. And my reasons for thinking about them are a long list of other questions in cosmology, in physics, that a lot of people are spending a lot of time on that seem to require thinking about the notion of time. Like, why are the laws that they are? Or why were the initial conditions of the universe as they are? If in a standard methodology of physics, the laws, the choice of the laws and the choice of the initial conditions are input, you're never going to have an explanation for what the input to your framework is from that framework. So I'm willing to push that boundary. Although I understand I'm taking a big risk. The issue of consciousness and experience to me seems beyond. I mean, I have deep respect for Roger Penrose, but I think I'm not convinced by what he's done in that domain. I think it's, believe me, I've thought about it. I don't know how to make any headway with it. So I'm happy to say sincerely that, you know, I'm very envious of the people in 300 or 400 years who may get to wrestle with that, just like, say, Newton or Leibniz should have been very envious of the fact that we can now wrestle with issues in physics and cosmology that they would have loved to have the empirical evidence to think about and just were able to philosophize about.
I'd like to come back to a point that you made at, before about the position of the observer between something happening here and on Andromeda. And although the emergent versus what I would term ideal version of time rather than real, that's why I was confused with your two terms, I'm wondering whether even the emergent model is still a very material-centric one. Does that make sense in this space of physics?
Sure it is. When you say material-centric, I mean, we're all materialists here. Yeah, sure.
That's a view from ourselves as material objects as well.
Yeah, let me introduce a distinction which is very important in the history of physics and the language of physics. It's the distinction between whether time or space are absolute or relational. This is the debate between Newton and Leibniz, and it's the currently the debate between, quote, background independent and background dependent forms of physics. If somebody is a relationalist, if they think that the properties of time are reflections of what happens, that what's real is some relationships amongst events, say causal relationships of what causes what, and time is an aspect of a set of relationships. But if nothing happened, if nothing caused anything, there would be no time. Somebody is an absolutist like Newton if they believe that time just exists and chunks along, okay, unaffected by whether there's anything happening in the universe, by whether there's anything in the universe or not. Okay, and then the things that do happen are slaves to that concept of time, but they have no influence on it. So I think everybody who thinks about these things carefully from the early 20th century on is a relationalist. I think that Leibniz won the debate with Einstein's work.
So Lee, I think we're going to have to wrap it up at this point. So I have a quick announcement to make. Let's start by thanking Lee for...
Thank you.